want to welcome on behalf of the court of Menominee Falls High School. Would those students please stand so we can identify them and recognize them? Thank you very much for coming. Please be seated. And we have Sun Prairie High School students. Would they stand, please? Well, we're delighted to welcome you all to the court. Please be seated. Both of these schools, as well as the Oregon High School, which was here for the first argument, are with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program that the court and the state bar have organized. And all the students have received summaries of the case that they are about to hear, and there are additional summaries of this case and all the cases today on the table outside the courtroom. We welcome you, and we hope you find this informative. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. To his left, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. So with the introductions made, I will call our second case this morning, which is Beard versus Lee Enterprises, number 96-3393, and representing Ms. Beard is John Stuber.
Good morning, members of the court, counsel for the defendant's planet, and all of the members of the public and the students that are here present today. Before we get too far in this case, I wanted to discuss the facts very briefly, because I think there may be some misconception of what the 16-year-old was doing at the time of the accident. This was not a coincidental trip. It was a special trip designed for a specific purpose in connection with the distribution of newspapers. Anthony and his father lived in Holman. Holman is located north of the city of La Crosse. Mr. Croplin's bundle delivery route was on the north side of the city of La Crosse, and further south still yet was the distribution center for the newspaper. On the morning that this occurred, Anthony drove through the north side to pick up the regular daily papers, went back north to the north side and delivered those papers. Rather than simply returning to his father's residence at that time, he made an extra and special trip back to the offices of the Tribune to pick up the Sunday supplements. And when he was traveling home with the Sunday supplements, that's when this accident occurred. And I think that's is significant to understand in the process of distributing newspapers that a daily paper is a lot smaller than the Sunday paper. The Sunday paper is filled with comics and news circulars and magazines, and those things cannot be accommodated by the normal delivery van. So in order to accomplish the distribution, we had to come back an additional time to the Tribune to get those supplements to his father's house so that they could be delivered on the outgoing trip. And so at all times, his activities furthered the purpose of distributing the newspaper of the La Crosse Tribune. To put this into some perspective, suppose that rather than hiring just this, his son, that Mr. Croplin had asked a cousin, a nephew, another high school friend. That person then would have had to travel to the home of Mr. Croplin, take control of the delivery van and begin the route there, and would have been continuously employed as he was returning the van to the Croplin residence and returning the Sunday supplements for later delivery.
Let me ask you, and as long as we're talking about the employee-employer relationship or the control, now, as I understand it, there was an agreement called the Independent Contractor Bundle Delivery Agreement. We have two agreements here, and then the other one was called the Newspaper Route Agreement. which that was with his brother. These were independent contractor relationships, allegedly. And I understand that under the statute 10321, talking about street trades, and then also under 10365, defining the relationship of a, someone working at a minor working. I just wondered here, this was a father who sent his son, and it wasn't a cousin, but it was a father who sent his son to pick up something. How did that establish, and I think this is, for me, important, the relationship or the employer-employee relationship between La Crosse Tribune and Mr. Anthony Cropleen? In other words, it seemed that in the affidavits, he said, I was employed by my father. I was not employed by La Crosse Tribune. But is there some special situation? Is that because of the street trades and distribution part of that?
I think there's a good contrast between what is typically understood as an employment relationship. Remember that the theory of respondeat superior depends on the principle that the employer for whose profit a servant acts should be responsible for the wrongs of the servant. Well, how do you determine that the servant, or that the person who caused the wrong directly was in fact a servant? Then you look back to the test of control. Did the person claimed to be the master have the right to control this particular individual? As between his father and the son, clearly that type of master-servant relationship existed. And so to answer your question, I think that that is something that does arise independent of the statute. But the statute, I think, imposes additional rules that have to be followed in the distribution of newspaper.
And can I just interject? Because I understood, and you were not arguing under respondeat superior. You're saying that that was, is that, I thought that you were arguing basically that that this was a statutory definition under the street trade, and it did not, that respondeat superior control did not come into this.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's exactly correct. We think that the liability of a newspaper publisher in this situation arises solely and directly from the conduct of distributing the newspaper. And the conduct in distributing the newspapers in prohibited hours and circumstances.
But that still depends, doesn't it, that this child is working for the newspaper? I mean, if I hire the child, I buy 20 newspapers. I'm just Shirley Abrahams living on the street, and I've decided that I'm going to help my neighbors out, because they'll deliver 20 newspapers to one house, but not 20 across the street. So I buy 20 newspapers, and I then have my young son deliver them to each of 20 neighbors down a 5 or 10 block street, okay? Now, my kid uses the car, and he does what happened here. He kills somebody. Is the newspaper liable?
It depends on how your position as a seller of the newspapers is determined. The statute clearly makes the publisher first and foremost responsible for the distribution of the newspapers.
Okay.
It does say that this responsibility can go from the newspaper to an intervening entity,
where
either a selling agent.
Yeah. Where does it say that?
In section 103.21.
Okay, I'm looking at 103.21 sub 1. This is another way of really stating what Justice Wilcox has asked, I think. And it says, every minor, that's my kid, selling or distributing newspapers, he's distributing them, right? On the streets or other public place, that's what he's doing, or from house to house, right?
Right.
Is in an employment and an employee, right?
Right.
And it says, and each independent news agency, or in the absence of such agency, each selling agency or a publisher, each publisher is an employer of the minor. So, why am I not the employer of my kid? Because I'm an independent news agency.
I don't know that that independent news agency is defined. And as an independent news agency, I guess there's a question of what that would be. Is that a company that distributes many papers or just one?
Okay, let's just put it this way. Suppose we agree for the moment that I am an independent news agency. I mean, I can give you an independent news agency like Midwest in town. I could do that. And suppose that the kid is now working for me as an independent news agency. Is the newspaper liable for him? My child, when I'm an independent news agency?
No, the responsibility then goes to the independent news agency.
It goes to me, and Lee Enterprises is out of this.
That's correct.
Okay. So, in other words, we've got to get this child, this minor, under the first part of 103.211.
That's correct.
We've got to find an employment relationship. Right? We have to find an employment relationship between Lee Enterprise and this youngster.
Correct.
Okay. That's all. I just wanted to clarify that. And now how do you get the employment relationship?
The employment relationship is defined right there, that the employment is the distribution of the newspapers.
Okay.
My question then would be, under the street trade, and when I looked at the independent contractor document that's in our record here, in your record, it seems to me, at least, that provision, that was the reason for that. We're trying to get around the independent contractor document. Obviously, you're saying that was a nullity, or would have no effect on this employer-employee relationship, right?
That's correct. And I think the issue is, what is the effect of that independent contractor agreement? Well, I don't think that a contract between two parties can change what the legislature has indicated the relationship shall be. And the one thing that is important, I think, to remember, and where we don't even get close to a question of having an independent news agency or a selling agency, is that, first of all, the facts would show that this father did not run an independent business, and second of all, there was no selling whatsoever involved in this particular distribution of newspaper. In fact, what the father hired out was...
Just distribution.
And if that's the case, and I'm just hypothetically saying, all right, then if we extend this, or is this just something that's going to deal simply with street trades? Because if we have, I was thinking in an agricultural situation, or house painting, or house repair, or anything, that if a person who has you have somebody come to your house and you have an independent contractor relationship, and that contractor brings someone who's 16 years of age, does that subject you to being an employer when you thought, well, no, this person was going to do this job and it was up to him to hire people? It's the extent of this that concerns me. Or are you trying to limit this just to street trades because that's a special situation? If it is, why is it special? What's special about this relationship?
Well, I think that it's special because the legislature has said it's special, and we are attempting to limit it only to the distribution of newspapers. And I think that there must have been concern in the legislature about the nature of the distribution of newspaper. And this legislation, I would understand it to read that it was designed to prevent abuses that had occurred or either here or other places.
Right. It went back to 1937, and then there was that case, and there was some concern. But here you have these two documents, and in fact, for the distribution, the distribution of the newspaper itself, which was his brother's contract, his brother was supposed to get a work permit, which was not obtained, which would give some notice to La Crosse newspaper or the employer, potential employer, that somebody else was doing this, that they would be able to have some knowledge, although you seem to indicate that knowledge is not that important here.
Well, I think that, we expect that a newspaper engaged in the distributing of newspapers will know what the rules are. And that's, I think, where their knowledge comes.
Well, Go finish your answer.
They don't have direct control in connection with that if they choose not to exercise the control. They certainly have it within their power to know who exactly was distributing their paper and to control and see that it was not done by a minor in unlawful circumstances.
Allow me to draw this out a little further because I still don't understand your position. Let us assume, okay, let's get away from you. I was a newspaper boy when I was a kid. I delivered for the Milwaukee Journal. So let's assume one of these people out here in this audience is a newspaper carrier for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, okay? And it's an employment relationship. Milwaukee Journal has hired them to be a newspaper carrier, to deliver 50 newspapers a night. Now, unknown to the Milwaukee Journal, whoever it is out here in this audience is the newspaper carrier, can't make it that one night. Gets sick or has a football game. So they hire the next door, they get the next door neighbor's kid to deliver the paper. And the next door neighbor's kid causes an injury to somebody else. Is that next door neighbor's kid, under your theory, an employee of the Milwaukee Journal?
I guess we have to step back one step and say...
Milwaukee Journal knows nothing about...
You would have to assume that this occurred, the delivery occurred in prohibited hours of employment.
Sure.
Right. Well, if that would mean that this hired carrier went outside the general parameters set up by the publisher and said, I'm going to deliver these papers at 3 in the morning, they're there after all, so I'm going to do it early.
No.
Because it has to be a violation.
Okay, then assume a violation. Or assume that the newspaper carrier that is hired by the Milwaukee Journal is an adult.
Is
an adult, so that they can deliver at 4 o'clock in the morning. But this adult hires a kid.
Okay, so your question is not whether there's a violation, it's just whether they're an employee?
Yeah. Because it sounds to me, Mr. Stuber, like you're enacting some kind of an absolute liability on a newspaper, like Lee Enterprise, for anybody who happens to be delivering a newspaper, unless there is an independent news agency between them or unless there's a selling agency between them.
Right, but the statute is very specific and limited to minors. So hiring an adult would say, no, this doesn't include hiring an adult. The employment has to do with minors. And are they employing the minor in the traditional common law sense? You look at right to control and exercise of control, but under the statute, you only look at distribution. So if, in fact, there is a minor carrier...
The next-door neighbor is a minor.
And they certainly are responsible.
Even though the newspaper knows nothing about the fact that that the person that they contracted with has gotten this kid to help him out.
I think that would be a fair statement. And I think it's part of the legislative policy to make sure that the children distributing our newspapers are properly instructed and it's made sure that they don't get up too early and deliver in the middle of the night.
So it's actually an absolute liability then on a newspaper company.
Yes, it is. I think that's how it's been formulated. Violations of child labor laws have been formulated as absolute liability based in part upon the express language of the legislature and then upon the courts reviewing this and determining that this particular level of conduct because of the significance of the conduct, should be treated as an absolute liability standard of care.
Mr. Stuber, I'm having a problem beyond what's been discussed so far. My understanding of the purpose of the child labor laws was basically to protect children. Now, as I understand your argument, you're taking that a step further, and you're saying that what we're doing in this case, or what we should do in this case, consistent with the dissent from the Court of Appeals, is we should not only protect children, we should protect those people who might be injured by a child who's in violation, if you will, of the child labor laws. How do you make that jump? What authority is for that? Is there for that jump?
I am making the jump, but I'm not doing it alone. You look first to the language of the statute that extends the protection for a violation not only to the minor, but also to frequenters at the place of employment. So the express language of the statute extends it to frequenters. And we had the case of McGarity, where the protection was in fact extended to a frequenter at the place of employment of a minor who was illegally employed. And the court, in evaluating that, says clearly this legislative intent goes directly to frequenters. So it's a jump I think that's been made already.
Well, but isn't there another jump that you're making? You're then saying, as I understand it, that the place of employment is the public roadway, and that anybody driving on the public roadway becomes a frequenter. Is that not the chain that you're following?
I think that in order to logically follow the legislative pattern, you have to determine what is the place of employment for a minor engaged in distribution of newspapers. We say that it is a street or other public place, but only to the extent that the minor is present and engaged in the distribution of the newspaper. Just because he's on a highway and there's an accident that occurs, that's not a place of employment. The minor employed illegally must be present, and the minor must be engaged in the distribution of newspapers. And so really it is I think it's a different circumstance than what's been decided in terms of rather than having a physical location such as I think it was a plumbing plant in McGarity, we have to look in this case at what is the appropriate place of employment for somebody who's engaged in distribution, and that can necessarily be very broad. But at all times here, I think there's good limitation on how far this extends, because we have to look in this circumstance as to whether or not he's actually engaged in the activity that's prohibited directly by the street rule. So I think it is an extension in the sense that we haven't reached those facts, but it's an extension that really has some very logical constraints on how far the rule should be extended.
Does the record show where the father of Anthony got the list of homes to deliver papers to?
I believe it's clear that the Tribune limited what they did to, for Mr. Croplin, was saying, these are the places the papers have to be delivered. Your job is to get them there on time and in good condition. That's, according to the affidavits, that's what they've indicated. But clearly, where to deliver them was determined. And I think, you know, there's many things about the specific mechanics that could be within the control of the Croplins.
Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about is that this whole thing is written as if the newspaper hires this minor, because you have to get a permit for him, right?
You mean a street trades permit?
Yeah, street trade, right.
For the regular carriers?
Right. Every employer of minors and street trades keep a record of each minor, name, address, receive and file a street trade, that's what we're talking about, right? Street trade permit, authorizing employment, keep the permit on file and allow inspection. So, I mean, the supposition is, you know who it is, and you take out a permit. And
yeah.
The supposition of Justice Babbage's question, you don't know who it is because your employee has now subcontracted, and maybe even after you tell the kid, can't do that. Either you deliver or you call us. You can't substitute somebody.
Right, and I think that does impose a significant burden on them, one that they cannot avoid by simply saying to someone else, you take care of the distribution of my newspapers. I know you're not a selling agency. I know you're not an independent news agency, but I'm going to let you take care of it. One of the things, for what it's worth, I guess, in the bundle of delivery agreement did not specify to Mr. Croplin that he had to now take on the duties that the Tribune had imposed on the statute, that he had to see that substitutes would get a permit.
But wouldn't he have to? Isn't the question, I think, is that the permit would be giving due notice, knowledge, some degree of association with the newspaper that wasn't there. In other words, the brother who had it written into his contract and the father who had the independent contractor relationship, they were the people that would, if they were going to have someone help them, would have gotten the permit. And obviously the permit would have been, I think the idea that the Chief Justice or perhaps Justice Babbage is talking about is that would have established some relationship. But without that permit, which gets them under the child labor, then they were operating, they were operating without permit, and therefore that was They had no knowledge.
Right. I think the concern is that the newspaper would be held responsible for an innocent situation. And the statute does not give any exception for innocent acts. Dog bite cases, we don't have innocent dog exceptions. Innocent knowledge, it says if the statute is violated, the liability flows.
So you think it covers when one kid signs out the obligation to the other?
I think it does. I can't see how it can be construed otherwise. I think that would mean it's up to the Tribune to go ahead and make sure that people are educated and that they're controlled.
And the limitation you're putting on is the statute itself, street trade, newspaper distribution, and that's it, not some other hypothetical that has been raised here, like working on a farm or working for a painting company or working for someone doing carpentry work or something else.
Right. I think this particular area of newspaper distribution, they've carved out a very specific and higher standard that the newspapers must adhere to. And I think in other areas you do a more typical right of control and knowledge situation. So I think it is limited in that way. Briefly, I'd like to just touch on the idea that a release of that was given to Anthony and his parents that the idea is that it would release the Tribune. And again, we are looking at an independent basis for liability. It's not vicarious liability where it's based on the right to control. It's completely separate. And I think that we've clearly shown in the law that this is something that's different. And contributory negligence, if a minor is injured, is not a defense. So basically the Tribune is stuck with whatever actions were taken by the distributor.
Shaking, I just have a follow-up.
So I want to make sure I understand your position with regard to the Perringer release. It's only because you're pursuing this under a statutory employee theory and not under a common law employee theory that you can survive the Perringer release. If you were going under respondeat superior, it's your position, you acknowledge that you would not be able to pursue your claim because of the Perringer. Is that correct?
I agree with that, with a little addition, is that our court has already looked at this particular type of conduct and elevated it, you know, beyond just simply negligence per se to an absolute liability and furtherance of policy. But I do agree with you exactly with it just a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stuber. We now have the next 30 minutes shared between Gerard O'Flaherty and Gregory J. Egan. Is that correct? Both representing Lee Enterprises et al. Okay.
Correct. May it please the court, my name is Gerard O'Flaherty and I'm representing Lee Enterprises. The La Crosse Tribune is a division of Lee Enterprises. I was intrigued by some of the depth of the questions that I've just heard, and I think I'd like to spend just a quick moment on the facts. Our brief went into a lot of detail on the facts, and I don't want to take all my time talking facts, but I would submit for your consideration that the delivery of this bundle route was not a street trade. The street trade statute does talk about distribution of paper and selling of papers. But when you read the statute in its totality, it talks about blacking of boots. And I think we're talking about the delivery of a paper to the retail, to the reader of the paper, the door-to-door route, the selling of papers on the corner. What we had here that Douglas Cropland had was a bundle delivery route. Just like the statute talks about down in subsection E, street trade, they even say the person that supplies, well, it's really up in one as well, the person who would supply the boot blacking material and towels to the youth who is doing the boot blacking is an employer. Not somebody who's engaged in a street trade, but really the street trade is meant to protect the children who are out there in the street, on the corner, walking the beat, throwing the papers, not someone who is conducting in effect, a wholesale delivery route here. Douglas Cropland had been an independent contractor for 11 years with the Tribune. And he decided to use his family members to assist him. The plaintiff and Mr. Stuber here are seeming to suggest that La Crosse Tribune should be able to tell Douglas Croplin, their independent contractor, that he is not permitted to have others assist him, to have his children help him out.
Is he an independent news agency?
I would not suggest that Douglas Croplin was an independent news agency.
Is he a selling agency? I'm looking down 103.2.
I understand that, and I anticipated that question. And it's a tough one because there's no good definition of a selling agency.
Yeah.
But and so I can't argue real strongly that he was a selling agency. But on the other hand, I don't hear any good arguments that he wasn't a selling agency. And I'm even suggesting that this bundle route was not what was intended to be covered by the street trade statute. It takes a vehicle to do this delivery. These are big bundles that are dropped off in the middle of the night.
It's selling agency of a publisher. The publisher here would be Lee Enterprise. Or in the absence of that, each publisher, and he's not a publisher.
So definitely not.
So, is it your position when you say this is not a street trade, is it because he comes in under each independent news agency or something there?
No, what I'm indicating is that this type of distribution of newspapers does not come within the ambit of the street trade. We had the Wachowski case that involved discrimination issue, but it went into great depth on what is the purpose of the street trade statute.
So you got to put it to each individual. It's got to move it to an individual subscriber or purchaser.
I think so, or have some regular exposure on the street, not merely driving a delivery truck or delivery van. Now, many of the people use a rather large truck as opposed to a van because of the size and the quantities here. I don't think it really comes within the ambit of the street trade.
Well, how did the newspapers get from his truck to the house?
How do they get to the house? A carrier. A carrier much like one of our justices here will show up at Quick Trip, say, with a drop site, and unclip the bundle of papers, load them in his bag, and walk or take a bike or have his mother drive him or whatever.
Those winters back then were really cold, much colder than today.
Yes.
A lot more snow, too.
Let me ask you under 103.65, it says a minor shall not be employed or permitted to work. And I was just wondering, now, you're taking the position, which we asked this question of your opposing counsel, that your position is, well, you didn't employ him. What about you permitted him? Does this raise any responsibility where you permitted the person to work at any employment, and this was late at night? He came to La Crosse Tribune after midnight, and he returned there at 3 in the morning. Now, both times were times that minors should not be working. They couldn't work before 5 or I believe after 9 at night. Now, permitting someone to work, is that different than employing somebody?
I think it is. I do think it is broader. But I submit under these facts that the La Crosse Tribune did not permit a work activity. I think the word permit implies that you would have some knowledge, some awareness, or that you should have known. And I don't think the facts here, the way the dock area, they had a contract for 11 years with Douglas Croplin. They were definitely aware that he came and picked up papers, bundle papers. And they were aware that he brought his son along. Okay. They were not aware that the son came on, at most, the record indicates is this was the second occasion where he came without his father to pick up the bundles.
Now, maybe my recollection of the facts were slightly different than that. I thought, and I don't want to get into factual dispute, but I thought that that not only did he accompany his father, but they knew who he was, and they knew on that particular night that with the dock area being open, visible, that Anthony was picking up the papers that particular evening. Now, are you saying that's different? If he had done it 15 times, then would they be in a different position under permitting to work than
yes.
one or two times?
Yes, I agree. I don't think the record is such that there's anything in the record that the Tribune knew that Anthony was there. In fact, Anthony's deposition testimony that's attached indicates that he didn't see anyone. The distribution office is on the second floor. They shoot the papers down, the neat circular chute, and you can call up there. But Anthony says he didn't speak with the manager of the distribution center.
Counsel, I want to test this new or control, because there seems to be a lot of questions about knowing and controlling. Do you concede that for purposes of a statutory employee, that it is irrelevant whether or not the employer knew or exercised any control?
I would submit that if the employee or minor employee came clearly within the street trade ambit, such as was doing the door-to-door route, except that that assignment thing was interesting, where they just asked somebody to fill in. But if they're standing on the corner of State and Madison selling papers, the publisher has to know who's doing that.
Let me take it.
I think that's the intent of the street trade statute.
For instance, we have in workers' compensation something very similar. Under 10206, there is a subcontractor under provision, which really provides that if I'm building a large building and I have a contract with a contractor, let's say a plumber, who then hires a 10 employees. I've never seen those employees. I don't know who those employees are. I have absolutely no control over those employees. But the legislature has said in that provision, we think workers' compensation coverage is important. So we're going to make these contractor unders statutory employees, even though you don't know them, you didn't hire them, you have no control of them, because it's important public policy that there be coverage for workers who are injured. Now, why isn't that the same here? Your opposing counsel argues the legislature has said there's an important public policy about employing minors during hours where they shouldn't be employed and violations of child work policies. So we're going to hold you as a statutory employer, just like we do in workers' comp, even though you didn't know who you were being, who was this contractor under, even though you had no control. I mean, isn't that what your opposing counsel is arguing, and how do you respond to that? That statutory employee is imposed because the policy of the legislature says we want this kind of coverage regardless if you knew, regardless if you have any control.
I agree with you. The legislature can set that policy, and I think they have with respect to minors who are actually engaged in a street trade. I submit that Anthony here helping his father with a bundle route as a family member under direction of his father was not engaged in a street trade.
So, counsel, if you win on that issue, that he was not engaged in a street trade, if you win on that issue, then from your point of view, you're home free. But if you lose on that issue, that he was engaged in a street trade, then you concede there is liability as a statutory employer. Is that correct?
In a limited fashion for injuries to the minor employee, the co-employees, and frequenters, but I don't buy the fact that everybody on the highway is a frequenter.
Okay,
the McGarity case can be easily distinguished.
Okay, so if he is in a street trade, you concede that he is a statutory employer in this fact situation, if it's shown that he's in a street trade. You don't yet concede whether or not the injured party is a frequenter. Is that then your position?
Correct. Yeah, but I also just submit that I don't believe the facts in the record indicate that he is in a street trade.
The counsel, excuse me, go ahead. do you distinguish at all between the father and his brother James? Because as I understand it, there were two deliveries. One was the bundle, the other was when he came back and he picked up the supplements and his brother's newspapers and apparently took them out to him. Is there any difference? Does it make any difference at all?
I think it does make a difference, and it's along the line of the examples given by Justice Babbage. What if somebody just had someone fill in? The Tribune had, again, I'm talking knowledge, but there's still the public policy. How intrusive will the publisher have to be in a family's life or an individual? How will they have to follow him around every step of the way? But this was a bundle, James's bundle that he was normally delivering in one apartment house, 15 papers, small bundle, was normally would be dropped off. And the James would pick that up and deliver it at 6 a.m. in the normal course. The fact that this family, on their way home with their van, thought that it saved them fuel, they didn't have to drive back and deliver it later in the morning, that a family member delivered it, the Tribune didn't catch that. But should they? I mean, that's where the Rockwhite case comes in. Is there some reasonable public policy here that would cut off? Just how far does the publisher have to go?
Well, isn't the stopping point, as suggested by your opposing counsel, that it's if we define this as a street trade, then that's a stopping point. We're not going to extend it to anyone else. It's just to the newspaper industry.
Well, that's true. It is applicable to newspaper industry and blacking of boots. It seems like the statute is focused on that. And I think that blacking of boots is interesting. It really indicates what type of street trade activity involving newspapers was considered here. And the Warshawski case points out to protect young people from the perils of delivering on a regular route down the same dark street. Now, this was a truck delivery situation.
I was never a newsboy like Justice Babbage, but I have helped them with their papers on occasion, and they get a bundle to deliver. It's left on between the street and the sidewalk right in front of the house for the kid to pick it up. He stuffs all of the stuff in that's supposed to go in there, especially on a Sunday. Then he delivers, but they seem to always give an extra supply of papers for some reason or other. It's not 50 right on the head. It'll be 52 or 54. Maybe they don't want to count so definitely at the publishers. But then the boy will go and sell, or try to sell, those extra copies on a busy street out in the boulevard. Now, has he become a street trader by the transfer from delivering to homes to now going out and selling the extra copies?
I think what would be interesting there is, does he become a selling agency where he's pocketing the money himself? That's a good one, but
it doesn't apply here.
Well, it's interesting. I would like to reserve some time for my co-counsel.
Wasn't he a street trader when he delivered to the homes?
Oh, yes.
Justice Steinman's example.
Yeah.
Okay,
there's no quarrel that there are legitimate minor street trade delivery of papers. No doubt.
We have a question from Justice Prosser.
Mr. O'Flaherty, did either Douglas or James collect any money from the people who received the paper?
No, they did not.
They just distribute, right? Okay, Mr. Egan.
Thank you. I'm Greg Egan, and like Mr. O'Flaherty, I have the privilege of representing the defendant respondent. We have a hybrid situation here in that liability, it is argued, is based upon a statute, 103.1, which says that an employee, a minor engaged in a street trade is in a quotation marks employment. The situation becomes more complicated because in this instance the minor child and his father Douglas have been released from liability pursuant to a Perringer release. So we need to ask the question, is the liability of the minor child vicarious liability arising out of an employment, like the statute says, or is it liability based upon some other theory? If it's vicarious liability, I think it's clear that by virtue of the operation of the Perringer release, the liability is barred by the release. and the statute clearly seems to indicate that the intent is to make the individual in the street trades an employee of the publisher. It's also, it's been argued in this case, to get around the impact of the Perringer release, that the court should extend liability as a matter of public policy to the publisher in a situation where the employee is working during hours that are prohibited. I think the critical issue that the court has to address is whether or not, as a matter of public policy, liability will be imposed on that basis. Yeah. The Court of Appeals considered that question and held that that was not a proper basis to impose liability. And one of the reasons cited was Wisconsin Statutes 343.06, which does not limit the times at which a minor may operate a motor vehicle. So there's a direct conflict between 70.06, 70.04, and 343.06 of the Wisconsin Statutes.
But wouldn't it be not good public policy that if a minor is operating in those time periods, the public policy would seem to be that if someone is doing something under in violation of the statute, then the public policy would be that there should be coverage.
Well, I think that part of the answer to the question is whether or not at the time that the offense occurred, the publisher was doing something to violate the statute. Here in this instance, the publisher allowed the minor to work in a street trade at a certain period of time. But at the time this accident occurred, the minor was on his way home. He was acting outside the scope of the employment. The publisher did not exercise any control over his activities. They didn't direct the method of his activities, the route. The kid was on his way home to go to bed. And the coming and going cases that deal with the scope of employment have usually held that an employee who was on his way home is acting outside the scope of employment.
How do you respond to the argument of your opposing counsel that, look here, part of his job was to distribute these inserts to the person who was responsible, the subcontractor, for distributing them, who in this case happens to be his dad. So he's taking, that's the argument on the other side, he's taking these inserts that have to be delivered to the subcontractor, the contractor, and that's what he was doing. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, we still take the position that he's acting outside the scope of his employment. This accident occurred on a Thursday night. The fact that he picked up the Sunday supplements and had them in the van, and it was a matter of convenience, but he's not acting within the scope of his employment at that time, at least by the publisher. If he's acting within the scope of anyone's employment, it's his employment with his father.
But under statutory employee, if he is acting under the employment of his father, he is automatically acting in the employment of the statutory employee. So you can't give that. You can't give that he is acting under the employment of his father, because that bumps you under statutory employee to liability on your client, it seems to me. If you give, you can't give that. If you give that...
In one sense, that's true. However, you need to recognize that the Perringer release releases both the minor and the father.
Is it your position that a Perringer release can also release strict liability in a statutory employee situation?
Well, I think the statute that's being relied upon here says that the individual in the street trade is in employment. And by virtue of the fact that the statute creates the employment setting, the Perringer release, to the extent that the Perringer release releases liability that's vicarious, the liability that arises out of the employment has to be vicarious liability.
And if it isn't vicarious liability, but strict liability, then it's not subject to release by A.
If,
Is that correct? If
the court determines as a matter of public policy that liability should be extended in this instance and given the particular facts of this case.
When you say extended, I guess sometimes it makes me nervous to extend things, you know. God forbid I ever extend anything. But if it is found that he is a statutory employee, and if it is found that there is a violation of the child labor laws, doesn't that make the employer strictly liable, regardless of vicarious liability? It's two different kinds of liabilities.
Sure. I mean, there is a basis to take the position that violation of a safety statute is a basis for finding negligence or negligence per se.
That's different, though, than liability. I mean, negligence per se, of course, deals with negligence and breach of duty, but liability is the whole banana. That is negligence, there's breach, there's causation, and there's injury.
All right, but there is still the question of comparative negligence. And that's a subject that Mr. Stuber touched upon, and that issue is significant in this case because of the Perringer release and the fact that the plaintiff is in effect satisfied that portion of her claim that arises out of the negligence of the minor or his father.
I'm a bit confused. My understanding was that Mr. O'Flaherty was taking the position that this is not a street trade. And I understand that. And you're in agreement with that position. You're now taking a different position that would support, again, no liability. And what I'm trying to do is get at what position you are arguing now. Are you still arguing it's not a street trade?
I agree with Mr. Flaherty that the conduct does not fit within the strict definition of a street trade. But assuming for the sake of argument that it does...
That's right. That's what I thought you were doing. So assuming for the sake of argument that it is a street trade, then your position is what? Just briefly state your position.
All right. Assuming that it is a street trade, then the liability of the tribune is vicarious liability based upon the negligence of the minor.
All right. So let me restate that if I can, and then you can tell me where I've gone astray. It seems to me your position is assuming that the child is in a street trade, that Lee Enterprise is not liable because Lee Enterprise is the employer and therefore is liable under the doctrine of respondeat superior. That they're not liable as under the doctrine of respondeat superior because, one, it's outside the scope of employment. That's one argument I heard from you. And then you can just stop there because he's on his way home and he's frolic or whatever you want to call it, detour or just outside the scope. Okay. Second argument I hear from you is assuming it's a street trade and assuming therefore that therefore the Lee Enterprise is liable vicariously only respondeat superior, you got a Perringer release and that releases Lee. Is that your argument?
Right.
Okay. Now, it's my... So, you're arguing the position of respondeat superior.
Correct.
Okay. Strikes me, and this is where I may be going astray, that the opposing side, Mr. Stuber, says he's not arguing that anymore. He's not arguing respondeat superior.
He's, but at the same time, his argument of liability as a matter of public policy is based upon 103.21,
right,
which says that the person in the street trade is in employment.
Right. And what he is saying is, I think, we're not going to argue responsibility here because this is not the typical employment case where the employer is liable for the negligent acts of an employee, right? That's the position you're taking. What he is saying is, here, the employer is not liable for the negligent acts of the driver, the youngster. The employer is liable for its own negligence. And that negligence is a violation of the statute by having a minor drive. So it's, he's saying it's out of responsibility. It's like, as an analogy, a negligent hiring and retention. The employer is liable for its own negligence. Right?
Right.
And that's his argument.
You're correct. He is making that argument.
And he's not making the respondeat superior argument at all. He says he gave that up. I mean, I don't know if he gave it up. Maybe your position is that that he really didn't give it up. He's bringing it in under a different cloak.
He's not making that argument in a direct sense.
Okay.
But he is arguing that the person employed in a street trade is in an employment. The question, I think, is whether or not, as a matter of public policy, the publisher is to be held liable, in this instance, for a violation of a street trade.
With all due respect to both counsel, this court is not supposed to be making public policy. This court is supposed to be applying the public policy by the state. So we're into a statutory interpretation to ask what did the legislature intend. Now, there's another concept of public policy that if, under common law doctrines of negligence, there's too far an extension of liability, the court under judicial policy can cut it. But you're not talking about that kind of public policy. I think you're talking about what the statute means.
Yeah, there's no indication in the statute that the legislature intended the child labor law to be a basis for civil liability to a third party.
Okay. Therefore, respondeat superior or no respondeat superior, you say Lee Enterprises is not liable.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, why don't you think that the statute covers public policy? It seems to me that you've got a very strong doctrine here about you don't employ minors, and it's not a general doctrine, it's in newspapers, because that's where youngsters traditionally were hired. That and shining shoes. I mean, any street scene of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s is going to have a kid delivering newspapers right out of Rockville, right? Newspapers and shining boots. I mean, it doesn't cover farms, where traditionally there's minor labor, but that's okay, right?
Right.
Doesn't cover house painting, right? So why don't you say here you got a strong public policy of no-no on these two trades, and your client violated it, and therefore pays the price?
Well, because we've got a situation here that, I mean, this is an industry, if you will, that's it goes back to the beginning of this country. Boys selling newspapers
right. It
for an hour. And historically, the relationship between the carrier and the publisher has been that of an independent contractor. They have not been employees.
But didn't the legislature change that? Isn't that the reason for 103.21?
Well, that's the argument. But, yeah. But I'm not aware of any case law that says that was the legislature's intention in enacting the child labor laws in this particular setting with respect to street trades. So if the liability is going to be extended based upon the fact that this minor was driving a car at prohibited hours, I think that's something that the court has to interpret the statute.
Do you have any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Egan. Mr. Stuber, you have some moments for rebuttal.
Thank you. I guess the argument that this was not a street trade is a little bit surprising, but because it hasn't been made. I think maybe the reason is that because on this particular night there was both bundle delivery and door-to-door delivery. But when you look at the definition of street trade under 103.21 sub 6, it has a long litany of things that make up a street trade. And all of the things in the beginning of this section are basically sales of items. And bootblacking, I think, is something separate and distinct. It's a sale of service. And so the addition of bootblacking, I don't think, is the type of thing to say all of a sudden. This meant to limit the scope of what we said earlier than that. I think they had to had bootblacking as a service. So the argument is that somehow the addition of this language made it just the door-to-door sales, I don't think is appropriate. I think the language of the statute is clear, and it deals with the selling or distributing of newspapers, and I don't see any limiting language. And if the purpose here is to protect the minor and frequenters of places of employment, then I don't see any basis for narrowly construing a statute.
Well, how about the limiting language that follows that, wherever it is, that says the selling and distributing from in the streets, number one, in the streets, or number two, other public place, or number three, from house to house is an employment. So you have to fit the selling or the distribution of newspapers on the streets, public places, or
by the public. So I think that the distributing goes is primarily done on the street, primarily in public places.
Counsel, I look upon this as a statutory interpretation problem. I'm not sure what selling agency means. I'm not sure what 103.21 means. In many places, it appears to be quite clear on its face, and yet I look at all of the other statutes that follow that, all the way up through the penalties that can be that an employer can incur, and it seems to me that if we're going to discern the intent of the legislature, which is our primary purpose here, we have to look at all of these statutes. And when I look at all of these statutes, at least right now, I'm pretty well convinced, and I want you to unconvince me if you can, I'm pretty well convinced that the statutory scheme envisions an employment relationship between the publisher and whoever is on the street with these newspapers, and that you failed to do so because there is no knowledge, primarily because there is no knowledge by the publisher that this kid is doing what he's doing. Now, why am I wrong?
Well, if we're going to look at statutory intent, I think we have to first look at the language of the legislature. And Justice Babbage, I just don't see any place where they're defining this based on knowledge or control. But rather, it seems to me that...
Well, there's all kinds of places in the statute that talks about the duties of the employers of minors. 103.27 talks about the duty. Every employer shall keep a record for each minor of his name, address, and date of birth. 103.25 talks about permits and identification cards. There's all kinds of duties that the statute in its entirety, the statutory scheme, I'm not just zeroing in on 103.21, but the entire scheme seems to imply to me anyway some kind of knowledge.
Well, I think that, again, the basic definition, and not the entire statute, but deals with the distribution of newspapers. It seems to me that what the legislature has said is, the newspaper, you're number one in this position. We're imposing the duty upon you. It gives them the opportunity to distribute their newspapers in whatever manner they wish. This duty can be delegated to an independent news service or to a selling agency. And I think they have the right then to determine how their newspaper is distributed. Presumably, they will know if they have minors employed. And presumably, they will tell these minors to be employed only during the permitted hours. But I think once they're given that duty and responsibility, they're presumed then to take on that mantle of responsibility and get the knowledge. So they can't just simply put their head in the sand and say, gee, we didn't know these kids were distributing the papers.
In other words, you could not diminish your responsibility by a independent contractor relationship like they had here. In other words, regardless of that contract, they still have the duty to know who was distributing their papers at all times.
That's correct.
Counsel, even if you should prevail here, this would have to go back for trial, wouldn't it?
I believe that it would, and I'm not sure how far you want to go on that, but clearly we have, if we determine that there is an absolute liability, I think there needs to be a sorting out of whether or not the contributory negligence, if any, of Mr. Beard should be considered. That issue really isn't before the court.
I know, this was a summary judgment. I just want to clarify that issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, both counsel, thank you very much. And that ends the oral argument on that case. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.